This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Tanya Mosley. Today, Terry has the first interview. I'll let her introduce it.
Before the Broadway musical Funny Girl turned my guest Barbra Streisand into a star, she was getting a lot of attention in 1962 for her nightclub act and for her show-stopping comedic number in the then-new Broadway musical I Can Get It For You Wholesale. That led to her being booked on The Gary Moore Show, which at the time was a popular TV variety show. Here's how she was introduced by Gary Moore in 1962.
You know, one of the biggest thrills for a guy who's been around this business as long as I have is the advent of a bright new young star. Several weeks ago, a very talented 19-year-old newcomer named Barbra Streisand did a comedy song in the Broadway musical I Can Get It For You Wholesale, and she stopped the show cold. Also, in addition to that, she appears nightly at the Bonsoir and kills the people there. But I was delighted to learn during rehearsals this week that she is equally effective in straight numbers as she is when she's being zany. Here, then, is Miss Barbra Streisand.
After that introduction, Streisand performed what became one of her signature songs.
Happy days are here again, the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
Barbra Streisand has a new memoir called My Name is Barbra. Her career got off to a rocketing start. In 1964, she won 2 Grammys for her first album, the Barbra Streisand album. She was nominated for Tonys for her 2 Broadway shows. Her first Oscar was for the film adaptation of Funny Girl. She became one of the best-selling recording artists of all time. In 1983, when Yentl was released, she became the first woman to write, produce, direct, and star in a major studio film. A new 40th anniversary release of the Yentl soundtrack includes 2 discs. The second is largely devoted to demo recordings featuring Streisand. She recorded her end of our interview from her home. Barbra Streisand, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the book. It is an honor to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Terry. Thank you.
Your memoir starts with how early articles about you focused on your nose. What? Why did you want to start with your nose? It's a 900-page book. Why start with your nose?
Well, what would you have started with?
I don't know. I didn't write the book.
Well, that's what I mean. I had to get their attention, you know, and it was also true. I mean, the articles about me that I remember, I had a researcher that researched me because I never kept a scrapbook even. And right away, I didn't like being interviewed and being asked certain questions. But even if the interview went well, I noticed that they printed something that was not nice. So what was that about? I never quite understood it. The negativity, you know, like mm-hmm. the picking on my nose wasn't that big ever. I didn't understand. I wasn't Jimmy Durante, you know?
Yeah. When you said picking on your nose, I was going to say instead of picking your nose, I'm sorry.
Picking on my nose, yeah. Though, yeah.
You decided you weren't going to get it fixed, in part because you were worried it would affect your voice, and for good reason, probably.
Well, yeah, my first instinct was that I liked my bump, and people would say, oh, you should have your bump removed or something. Why would I remove my bump? And I just had a problem with the tip of my nose, but I wasn't faithful that any doctor would do something so tiny, you know? I probably wouldn't like it. The third thing I thought about was, way later, was, it might affect my voice, my nasal quality, you know, seeming was liked. So why would I change it? Mm-hmm. I don't like pain. I mean, I've seen people with the bandages on their nose, and sometimes they're not happy, and sometimes they take too much off and you can't put it back. I don't know. I just didn't want to take a chance. And it was expensive, remember? when I was growing up, expensive. We didn't have the money to do anything like that. But, you know, it just, no, I decided I'll try to just make it on my own and make it about who I was, really.
Early on, when you were starting out, you performed at the Bonsoir, which you describe as a sophisticated nightclub in Greenwich Village. And there's a you did a live recording from the club that was never released in 1962 when it was recorded, but it was released last year in a remastered version. So to talk about your early career, very early career, I want to play a track from that. And I thought we'd hear Keepin' Out of Mischief now because it's quite delightful. So here it is, Barbra Streisand, live in 1962.
Keeping out of mischief now. Really, I'm in love and how. I'm through playing with fire. It's you whom I desire. All the world can plainly see. You're the only one for me. I have told them in advance they can break up our romance, living up to all my vows, 'cause I'm keeping out of mischief now. Out of mischief now. I'm in love.
That was Barbra Streisand, recorded in 1962 at the club The Bonsoir. You wanted to be a dramatic actor at first. Why did you think of singing as secondary to drama?
Because I wanted to be on the stage and play, you know, Juliet and A Doll's House, whatever, you know, Ibsen, Chekhov, Shakespeare. And to sing to me in a nightclub was not what I imagined my career to be. Because I knew I had a pretty good voice and I was living with a man who had a great record collection, and he said, there's a club across the street. It was a little club called The Lion. And that person, the head of that, the manager of that club, took me over to the Bonsoir to audition. And that's how I got a job. It was a wonderful job, and I met Phyllis Diller. You know, we shared a tiny little dressing room together. She was great. She was a great friend to me.
How did you realize you should try Broadway musicals? So you wanted to be a dramatic actor, then you started singing at a club, and then, of course, you started auditioning.
I went to acting classes where I could play the roles I wanted to play. My first acting class when I was 14, taking the train from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And I tried out for the Actor's Studio when I was 15. So when I didn't get jobs, I decided I had to make a living somehow. I went to that talent contest and won. And that's how I became a singer.
Mm-hmm. So you kept auditioning, and you got a part in I Can Get It For You Wholesale, which was, you know, a musical comedy on Broadway.
I had a wonderful serendipitous, is that such a thing, a word? Serendipitous, yeah. I had a wonderful agent who saw me in Another Evening with Harry Stoons, a little off-Broadway play. That lasted 9 previews and 1 performance. But he saw me in that. And he's the one who set me up for I Can Get It For You Wholesale, that first Broadway play. Now, you know, it didn't matter to me if I lost roles because I really wanted to be an actress. I mean, that's when I came in and said, you know, when I had to sing they gave me the sheet music for Miss Marmalstein because she was originally written to be an older woman. And they changed it for me. I was only 19 years old. And that's the story I tell, coming back and saying, I'd like to do the song in a chair.
Yeah, she's a secretary, so you wanted to be in like a secretarial chair on wheels.
Yeah, but they didn't have a secretarial chair. But my vision of it was that I would sing the song in a secretarial chair.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, it's logic. It's like I got the job. And then when we started rehearsal, they said, now we're going to stage it. Well, what do you mean? Didn't you like my idea of singing it in a secretarial chair? Well, it was okay, but now we're going to, you know, go to work and do a conceptual, you know, staging with lots of people in the office and so forth.
Yeah, well, what happened to the chairs? Yeah. You kept persisting like this is how it should be, and you won.
That's the point.
Yeah.
The point is I always had these visions of the way things should be. But I also believed in trying to do to the best of my ability what the director wanted. I mean, I really tried to make it work for myself, but it just felt so awkward, so not right.
Because you were just like, what, standing around while other people were on stage too? You were just standing and singing?
Yeah, it just didn't feel right. And finally, right before we went to Philadelphia, I think that was first, Philadelphia and then Boston. Philadelphia, you know, he said, do it in your goddamn chair. And it stopped the show. I almost felt guilty, but I was happy that it worked.
Why don't we hear it? So this is Miss Marmelstein from 1962 cast recording of I Can Get It For You Wholesale, featuring my guest, Barbara Streisand, who has a brand new memoir.
Miss Marmelstein!
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 Miss Marmelstein! Oh, why is it always Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein!
Miss Marmelstein!
Miss Marmelstein!
Miss Marmelstein!
Miss Marmelstein!
Other girls get called by their first names right away. They get cozy into May. Do you know what I mean? Nobody calls me, hey baby doll.
Miss Marmelstein.
Or honey dear.
Miss Marmelstein.
Or sweetie pie.
Miss Marmelstein.
Even my first name would be preferable. Though it's terrible, it might be better. It's Yetta. Or perhaps my second name, that's Tessie. Spelled T-E-S-S-Y-E. But no, it's always Miss Marmelstein.
Miss Marmelstein?
You think at least Miss M they could try.
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Oh, I could die.
That's Barbara Streisand in the 1962 original cast recording of I Can Get It For You Wholesale. That is just delightful.
It worked. And I was happy about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you wanted to do dramatic acting, and so, like, your big breakthrough is in a musical comedy. But you were already doing comedic songs.
I didn't get the jobs of the straight shows.
Yeah, why do you think that is? I mean, when you wanted to be a dramatic actress, what kind of roles did you think you'd get? Because when you were young and going to movies to escape being home, basically— you thought to yourself, the girls on screen don't look like me. And they probably didn't, you know.
No, they didn't. They didn't. I mean, the stars, anyway.
Yeah, so what were you expecting to get initially?
Wow. I just somehow always saw my future. I can't explain that to you. Maybe it was my mother's negativity. I don't know if it was like, I'll prove you wrong. Because she kept telling me to get a job as a secretary.
Well, you got to play a secretary. That's close.
I sure did. I think it's hard for sometimes parents who would have loved a career for themselves to have their kids become what they wanted to be.
And your mother wanted to be a singer, yeah.
Yeah, she had a beautiful voice, my mother.
Mm-hmm. You credit some of your insecurities to your mother, who was always criticizing you. And I want you to name some of her more memorable and cutting criticisms. I'll start with my favorite of the ones that you mentioned in the book, is that she used to send you bad reviews. And when you'd say, "Why are you sending this to me?" she'd say, "You need to know about this. Don't get a swelled head." That's pretty destructive, considering how sensitive you are about some things. So what are some of your most memorable criticisms she made of you?
God. Well, when I first allowed her to... she came the second night when I was at the Bonsoir. My mother, the first thing she said, I remember, was, "Your voice needs eggs. You have to use a guggle muggle because your voice needs to be stronger."
What's a guggle muggle?
A guggle muggle. A guggle muggle was, she made hot kind of chocolate and put a raw egg in it, which I could never swallow. Ugh. My mother came twice, once to see me as a singer and once to see me as an actress. When I came off the stage as an actress in my acting class, we put on a little show, her comment was, "Your arms are too skinny."
So your mother was very critical of you. Your father died when you were 15 months old, so you never really got to know him. Your stepfather you describe as not physically abusive, but emotionally abusive. What did he...
He never saw me. He never talked to me. Mm-hmm. Literally, I can say to you, I don't remember a sentence or even a word hello. It was like I wasn't seen. It's like I vanished in front of him. He would not talk to me. So I think my early upbringing did affect my wanting to be famous in some way or an actor, you know, because I wasn't seen. Mm-hmm. What a way to be seen. You become an actress, I guess, you know. You become a movie star. Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about music. So you are very brave. You a couple of times asked Stephen Sondheim to add a lyric or change a lyric
yes.
for you. And so I want to ask you about Send in the Clowns. In the show that's from, A Little Night Music, you know, it's about a couple who he was in love with her, and then by the time she's in love with him, he's kind of married, so he's no longer available. And, you know, years pass. So anyways, in the song, you thought that since it wasn't done in the context of the show, that people wouldn't get what the lyrics were really about.
So exactly.
You asked Sondheim to add... A second bridge to kind of explain what was happening. How did you have the nerve to ask Sondheim to write something for you?
You know what? Because I knew him. He had a strange mother like I did, who didn't believe in him.
Right.
And therefore, I could talk truth to him. I know who he is. And I know that he's always... like me, in a sense, looking for something even better than what you did before. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are certain people who would never change a lyric.
So what'd you think of the bridge that he wrote for you?
Loved it.
Yeah, it's good.
Loved it. I didn't even know, because I don't remember seeing that show. Or if I did, maybe I left at intermission, but I don't remember... I didn't remember the story. And then when he told me, when I called him, he says, "You know, you're saying something that really happened on stage. There was time. And you're asking me to write something else that's really filling that time for a record." And he said, "So I was really glad to do it." You know, it's just amazing how... You know, another time I asked him about another, I was reading the sheet music, which I can't read.
Hold
I see
hold
the
that
notes.
Thought, because before we change the subject, I want to play it. So we're going to be hearing a little more than just the part that Sondheim wrote for you. So I want to point out to our listeners which is that part in case they're not that familiar with the lyrics. So it's the part that he wrote for you is the part that starts, "What a surprise, who could foresee, I'd come to feel about you what you felt about me." So it's those two lines plus two other lines. Okay, so here we go. This is Barbara Streisand.
Don't you love farce? My fault, I fear. I thought that you'd want what I want. Sorry, my dear. But where are the clowns? There ought to be clowns. Quick, send in the clowns. What a surprise. Who could foresee I'd come to feel about you what you felt about me? Why only now when I see that you've drifted away? What a surprise.
That's Barbara Streisand with an extra bridge written for her at her request by Stephen Sondheim. Thank you for enduring the ordeal of being interviewed.
Well, thank you, Terry, this is 10 years we're talking about.
That you wrote
more
the book.
More than 10 years that I talked to you.
Oh, since you've been on the show, yes. Well, it's time to let you go and to let your dog growl in peace.
Yeah, I'm going to go have a treat for my doggies now, too.
Barbara Streisand's new memoir is called My Name is Barbara. She spoke with Terry Gross. Our next guest is Tariq Trotter, better known as Black Thought. His life, as he remembers it, starts with a fire. He was 6 years old, deep in play with his army men, those popular plastic figurines from the 70s, when he decided to flick a lighter to add drama to the war scene. When the tip of the lighter got too hot for Tariq's little fingers, he reactively tossed it, the curtains and carpet erupting in flames before engulfing the entire house. In Trotter's new book, The Upcycled Self, a memoir on the art of becoming who we are, the Grammy Award-winning rapper and co-founder of the hip-hop group The Roots examines the shame of that moment, as well as other harrowing events growing up in Philadelphia, intertwined with joyful moments like discovering music and meeting his fellow bandmate Amir Questlove Thompson. Known by his stage name, Black Thought, Trotter is the lead MC of The Roots, which he and Thompson founded after meeting as teens in high school. Here's one of their first hits from the album Things Fall Apart, You Got Me, featuring Erykah Badu.
We used to live in the same building on the same floor and never met before until I'm overseas on tour. And peep this Ethiopian queen from Philly taking classes abroad. She's studying film and photo flash focus record. Says she working on a flick and cut my click through the score. She says she loved my show in Paris at Elise Momar and that I stepped off the stage and took a piece of her heart. We knew from the start that things fall apart. Intent to shatter, she like that it don't matter when I get home. Get at her through letter phone. Whatever, let's link. Let's get together. This shit you think not. Think the thought went home and forgot. Time passed. We back in Philly. Now she up in my spot. Telling me the things I'm telling her is making her hot. Started building with her constantly round the clock. Now she in my world like hip hop and keep telling.
The Roots serve as the house band on NBC's The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon. And in addition to his music, Trotter is also a theater actor and writer, having co-written the music and performed in the off-Broadway play Black No More. Tariq Trotter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
This memoir is about you going back through your life to understand who you are. And that fire that you accidentally started at 6 years old, you write that it became the basis of all that you are. But to say that it changed you isn't quite right. It actually shaped the person that you are. What did it shape you into?
I think, you know, the fire and that whole experience at such a young age, it changed me in that it jump-started. It was the beginning of me having to grow up, you know, fast. Yeah, and, you know, when I, you know, go back in my life and I trace through, you know, like those watershed moments. And I think, you know, as a kid, I mean, you know, I was 6 years old, so there was no way at six for me to really understand the gravity, you know what I mean, of it all, and how that's the sort of thing that could carry through life, you know.
At the time, you were living with your mother and your half-brother in a house that your mom had done this amazing job making a home in North Philadelphia. She did not blame you or scold you, but it was clear that it had changed your family's life. There was very much a before the fire and an after the fire for your family. How, in those immediate days and weeks and really years, did things change for you all? It really destabilized you.
Yeah, it definitely, it was the beginning of just a more unstable period in our lives. One of the things that, a revelation that occurred post-fire, like right after the fire, was just the fact that I didn't get in trouble. There was no doubt in my mind that I was, you know, going to get it. You know what I mean? I knew that I had really done it this time. And I was expecting, you know, some, if not multiple, manners of punishment, right? And, you know, there wasn't really a reprimand. Like, you know, my mom, I mean, obviously now as an adult and as a parent, you completely understand that the only concern would be for your kid's safety. But in that moment, I felt like, wow, you know, she's let me slide with this one. But, you know, I think I came to, like, the revelation was the amount of grace, you know what I'm saying, that my mother was able to show in those moments, right, you know, that felt as if such a display would be impossible.
You talk about how much you had to grow up after that fire. You got your first job at 7 years old?
Yeah, I did. 7 years old, I was working at an eyeglass for an optician, because I started wearing glasses at around at the age of six or so. And this place, this optician was along the route, my route to and from school, which, you know, often I would be traveling alone or with, you know, another young 5 or 6 year old kid.
It and, really speaks to the time, because
it like, really does. It does, you know, because we would just be out there back in the day. Your parents would go to work and just, you know, go to school. I hope you make it. You know what I'm saying? My trek to school, it was a couple mile walk, and you know, this was, you know, the winters in the 70s and early 80s, when it was the real deal, you know, super cold out. And but yeah, anyway, this guy, this optician, where I would often stop to ask him if he could repair my glasses before I got home from school, I think he just, you know, sort of felt the vibe. He read the room of sorts, and was, you know, he realized that I was a latchkey kid who was often, you know, headed home from school to an empty house. Mm-hmm. And he provided, you know, an alternative in saying, hey, would you accept these responsibilities? And would it be okay if I talk to your mom and, you know, figure something out? And he spoke with my mom, and she was with it. I had a job.
You write about these times so vividly, and you also write about some heavy things that allow us to understand and see you more clearly, in addition to the fire that forever changed you. You also lost both of your parents at a very young age. Your father was murdered when you were a baby, and your mother was murdered when you were a teenager in a very brutal way.
Yes.
I'm guessing for a very long time, you did not lead with this part of your life. Did people in the entertainment circles and around you know these things about you?
I mean, you know, my closest friends definitely, you know about my history and, you know, what my life has sort of been like. But no, I think I'm guarded in that way. I'm such a private person that it's almost as if you weren't there at the time, there's no way that you, you know, you'd have any idea. I've never worn my lived experience as that sort of badge, you know, or on my sleeve in that way.
You didn't find out right away that your mother had been murdered. No. You had been living in Detroit and with relatives. You were a teenager and you'd come back to Philly, mm-hmm. and you couldn't find her. And so you went out to search for her. And one of the places you went to after calling and driving around was the morgue. And yep. that's where you found her.
Yeah, yeah. You know, not me personally, but that's where our family found her. And it was, you know, one of the sad, you know, just realities of life, you know, in Philadelphia. And at the time that, you know, I was, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, I mean, you know, just in the middle of the 80s crack epidemic. And then, you know, immediately after, you know, just the crack epidemic and everything that took place. Yeah, you know, we had normalized lots of trauma and lots of, you know, things that, you know, we had gotten used to seeing and experiencing every day. You know, it just wasn't necessarily okay and wasn't necessarily normal. And, you know, one of the normal things for us was that, you know, that's what you do if, you know, someone doesn't show back up home at the end of the night or the next morning, or you're trying to track somebody down. First, you check the hospitals, you know, see if, you know, maybe they've gotten hurt and wound up in the hospital. Then you check, you know, the jails, see if they have been arrested. And then you check the morgues. And we, in that order, that's what we always did. And that was a process. And then my mother, you know, she would always turn up after a couple of days. And this particular time, I think it was something that we all felt, you know, just an eerie feeling. It felt different. And once we had found out that there was a Jane Doe that had turned up, like an unidentified or unidentifiable body, I think we all knew that or felt that was my mother. And then my grandmother and her sister went and confirmed at the morgue.
When you found out your mother was killed, you were in high school, and you had this good friend, Amir Questlove Thompson. What did that friendship mean to you through that time period?
Through that time period, you know, Amir and my friendship was huge. It was an anchor for me. You know, the ways in which he and his family were there for me, they really had taken me in. The dynamic was already one in which I would spend days, weeks at a time at his place, and vice versa. You know, we were inseparable in that way as creatives. But the fact that I was able to pour myself completely into my art, and that the music was there for me when I needed it to be, and, you know, just that Amir and his family was there for me. It was huge. It was just the perfect, you know, safety net to sort of keep me on the right trajectory, because I was very much at a crossroads, and I could have processed that trauma and the experience and the loss in a different way, and, you know, just been, you know, at a very different place today.
The Roots was also one of the first rap groups to play live music. There are so many elements of jazz. Was it hard for you guys in the beginning? Did record companies know what to do with you?
Yeah, no. Record companies had no idea what to do with the Roots. So, yeah, we looked different. We sounded, you know, different. You know, I spoke and performed differently. Both Malik and I, the other MC, you know, rest in peace, Malik B, the other MC in the Roots,
yeah.
You know, spoke differently than, you know, folks did from places that were, you know, trending more in the culture. Like, you know, there was a specific way that rappers in the West Coast or from the South or even from New York, you know, said things. And from Philly, we sounded different. There was no, Philly wasn't the incubator for us that it's been for some other artists at different points in time.
When I look at you guys, I mean, you're not just a band. You're like a collective.
Absolutely, we are.
Yeah, I mean, so in any given iteration, they're almost like a dozen members, but they're... there's also all of these other connective tissues around Philadelphia of other artists that you all introduced us to. So you all basically set that foundation, that culture that we know of like this Philly sound of neo-soul hip-hop.
Yes. Yeah, we did. It began with just jam sessions that we would have at Amir's house or at our manager, again, rest in peace, Rich Nichols, at Rich's place. Then we wound up arriving at a residency at a place called the Wetlands here in New York City. And then after doing the Wetlands for a while, it became so, testosterone fueled, and it was just so male energy dominant that we wanted to create another platform just to give, female energy and, just to give that, the feminine a place to showcase and perform. And that's from that, the Black Lily was born. And then that's really the beginning of the Black Lily was, it ushered in an era.
Can you describe a Black Lily? Yeah, what that
yeah.
is.
Yeah, well, a Black Lily was the answer to the initial, the original Roots jam session, where it's lots of improv. It's almost all, think of an Upright Citizens Brigade or something for, but that is for the comedian, right, for the sketch comedian, having to, just to learn to improvise and create and entertain on the spot. That's what the Black Lily was. It was an incubator for artists like the Jill Scotts and Kindred Family Souls, and Music Soul Childs and Bilal's, of the world.
Your rap cadence, it's always been instrumental, if that makes sense. MCs before you, they had maybe a louder, bombastic kind of projection, and you're much more melodic. How did you come into your style? Did you ever emulate some of those earlier guys? You talked about Kool Moe Dee when you were really young, but
yeah, I did. I've definitely emulated, all the greats. If we're talking cadence, then it began with the Melly Mel. Right. And the way that, the Melly Mels of the world sort of spoke, there was a cadence that was, it was almost, like your uncle at the barbecue. Right. really accessible, easy to follow along. But even in that, Melly Mel was the first artist to, he rapped, his cadence was very different from okay, we begin with the Sugar Hill Gang, right? The way that, the hip, the hop, the hipper to the hipper, the hip, hip, the hop. You almost got a smile to rap in that cadence, right? And Melly Mel came out and he was, talking about the Bronx and rapping about what was, really going on songs like, The Message. And he was emphatic in his expression, Broken glass everywhere. And you could, it was visual, The way that the emphasis he put on his words made it possible for you to see what he was talking about. And then you had the, Run DMC and those guys came along, right? Through, I guess the connective tissue would be Curtis Blow, right? Who was, the first sex symbol solo rap star. But, again, he didn't rap in the way that, the Melly Mels or the Sugar Hill Gang did. And he introduced us to Run as his DJ Run. And then when Run DMC came out, they were almost the antithesis to everything that was happening on the scene before them. I feel like that's what Def Jam and, the people who were associated with Def Jam and Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin at that time, they all were yelling and screaming. They came out and it was like, we're not going to rap the way these other guys rap. Like, it was Public Enemy, Beastie Boys, Tila Rock, LL Cool J, Run DMC, who they weren't Def Jam artists, but they were part of that movement. Yeah. And then you had artists like, Rakim and Big Daddy Kane and Kool G Rap, who came out, and for them it was about more nuance. And in particular, I think that's, it goes for Rakim, who, many of us like Talib Kweli, Yasiin Bey, Nas, myself. There's a long list of us who sort of trace it back to, to him. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah, to the influence of Rakim. He was one of the first MCs who said, I know everyone else is screaming and yelling to get their points across. Everyone else is going to be super emphatic. I'm going to articulate my instrument as such. I'm going to use my voice like an instrument. And, he had a jazz background. I think Rakim, grew up playing trumpet or sax, and his brother also was a jazz musician, his older brother. And he approached his cadence and his storytelling and his songwriting from that perspective. And I think that was, some of the earliest signs of that. And that's what, it's a tool that I still employ today.
Well, to give an example of your instrument, how you use it, I want to play one of your more recent songs, which is a personal track about your life and family, and it is called Fuel. Let's listen to a little bit.
I'm in Ernest Hemingway portrait painted by Ernie Barnes. Clean sneakers and dirty horns. Last soldier of 30 gone, who lost hope but still journeyed on. Yet I'm the reason we gon' have to get the gurney for 'em. Karma police carrying customized cuffs for me. I hope these taped up guns are still bust for me. I had the whole world that wasn't enough for me. It got me feeling like the Lord lost trust for me. I made a means to an end when there were no wins. I burnt bridges I'd sworn to be eternal friends. The last ones I ever intended to turn against, until we grew our separate ways like fraternal twins. So to the chosen few with whom I need to reconcile, my mother's mother, my only brother, my second child, I've always loved you, although that was rarely said aloud. So take forever, I guess better late than never proud. Listen.
That was Fuel by Black Thought, released in 2020. And this song, this goes back to what we're talking about you through your art expressing what has happened in your life. It's about intergenerational trauma, reconciling the past and building a future. What's your writing process? Are you putting your rhymes to paper from the start, or does it just start with an idea and a freestyle?
The process is different from song to song. I'm constantly jotting down ideas, a word here, a couplet there. But, for the most part, the writing process is, I sit down and I try and think of, just different ways to either add on to or to, continue to articulate the, just my origin story, sometimes I'll hear a bit of music and I'll sit with the music for days, weeks, months at a time, before some lyrics will come, right? A song will eventually write itself after the 20, 30, 40th time that I've decided to sit and listen to this, this idea. And then other times, I'll get 32, 40, 50, bars will just come without any sort of musical inspiration. Then I have to find, a fitting composition, the best place for these words to sort of live. So, I'm pulling my ideas out of the ether, and I try and just remain dialed in, tapped in, attentive, alert, aware, conscious enough to, to receive that inspiration and to recognize it when it comes, because it's all around you. It's, everything is a song, right? It's just about, recognizing the gold.
Your kids are living a very different life than you lived as a young person in Philadelphia. And that's a positive thing. I mean, you write about it in your book. Do they know about your story and the different parts of you, and how has it felt, if so, to be able to share those things with them?
My kids don't really know. I don't think they know about my story as much as they, could or should. But again, I haven't really impressed it upon them either, right? Because it's not the sort of thing that I've worn on my sleeve. They just, I don't know. The ways in which we protect our kids, sometimes we withhold information. I talk about this in the book about how I'm still, trying to figure out information, receiving information about exactly what, you know, what exactly happened in the case of my father's murder, right? So I think they're going to continue to, you know, to hear sort of, again, about the pieces of the puzzle that, you know, make me. And I think over time they'll get into it. I think they'll appreciate the fact that, yeah, I was able to tell this story, you know, but probably further down the line. You know, right now my kids, they feel oblivious to a lot of what's going on, a lot of what's happened in my life, and a lot of, you know, what's happened in the world. And I think there is a, you know, there's a certain level of privilege and, you know, associated with that, with that, the bliss of that ignorance, you know what I mean? And sometimes I find myself, you know, just wishing they had it, just a tougher way to go, you know.
Do you feel good though that you've been able to provide them with that privilege?
I definitely feel good that I've been able to provide them with that privilege, you know, in many ways, you know what I'm saying? Because I never, you know, as a kid, yeah, I didn't know what I was going to wind up doing or how long I was going to even, you know, live, right? That's what the sad truth. Lots of us didn't think, we couldn't see ourselves making it past 25 or 30 just because we didn't know that many people who had, you know. And then the people, you know, it was almost as if a generation had been skipped, because I knew people who were my grandparents' age, and I had, you know, friends and classmates who were my age, but, you know, the drug epidemic in the 80s took a whole generation of people out of here. So it was like, you know, oh, will you see yourself at 30? And I would say, who's 30? Who made, I don't know, who made it to 30? You know what I mean?
Tariq Trotter, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, no, thank you, Ty. This has been a great conversation. And yeah, I'm excited. I can't wait to hear this.
Tariq Trotter, a.k.a. Black Thought, on his new book, The Upcycled Self, a memoir on the art of becoming who we are. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Tanya Mosley.